Income inequality has become one of the most talked about political and economic issues in recent years. In this next hour, we hear from three guests speaking on income inequality and what you can do about it. First, we hear from Professor Lydia Cepeda with the UW-Madison Department of Consumer Sciences in the School of Human Ecology. Her research focuses on food production, consumption, and excess. She is followed by Charlie Upoff, a board member with the Madison Institute, and Barbara Lawton, former Lieutenant Governor of Wisconsin. The talk took place on November 14, 2015, at Union South on the UW-Madison campus and was sponsored by the Madison Institute. Now, Professor Lydia Cepeda.
A billionaire, Joseph Lau, bought a 12-carat blue diamond for $48 million. This is this is basically to illustrate inequality. This is perhaps, I think, the highest price that a diamond has ever sold for. Earlier in the week, he bought a 16-carat pink diamond for $28 million for his 7-year-old daughter. Because every 7-year-old needs $76 million worth of diamonds, obviously. I'm not saying that dads shouldn't, you know, do things for their daughters, but the interesting thing about Joseph Lau is that he has actually been convicted of bribery in Macau and sentenced to 5 years in prison, but he is actually in Hong Kong right now, and there's no extradition treaty between Hong Kong and Macau, so he will probably never serve time. What could $76 million buy? It could send 276,000 girls to school with that money. And it's pretty flabbergasting when you think about what that could buy. This is really illustrative of the fact that billionaires have so much money, they really don't know what to do with it, and they're bidding up these few sort of precious metals. And when you think about how productive is a diamond, what does that produce? Does that produce jobs? Does that produce anything? No. Well, maybe a few jobs at Southby's. So I think that's, like I said, I just thought that was an interesting news piece given the topic. So I wanted to just cover a little bit of terminology before we get started. And income is basically our earnings, what we get in paychecks or salary. Wealth is ownership. So it's our assets minus liabilities. And income inequality is usually measured by something called a Gini coefficient. And this is what economists use to measure income inequality. If you have complete income equality, so if everybody shares everything, then you have a Gini coefficient of zero. If you have complete inequality, the Gini coefficient is one. So that means one person owns everything. And it's used to measure how countries' income inequality is changing over time. And it's generally characteristic of developing countries that Gini coefficients are higher in developing countries. So these are Gini coefficients for OECD countries. These are mostly the middle income and high income countries. And you'll notice where the U.S. is towards the top. I just want you to see that, you know, basically the Gini coefficients go down the scale, so the U.S. is up at the high end. And in fact, the OECD average is 0.34. Remember, they're 0 to 1. 1 is most unequal. 0 is most equal. So the most equal countries in the world are Denmark, Slovenia, Slovak Republic, and Norway. They have Gini coefficients of 0.5. In the Czech Republic, Iceland and Finland then have the next most equal income distribution. Switzerland, surprisingly, has a fairly equal income distribution. I mean, we don't tend to think of Switzerland as being fairly equal. Germany is 0.29, France 0.31, Canada 0.32, UK 0.35. So these are some of our allies. We are the fourth most unequal country in the OECD. We're behind Chile, Mexico, and Turkey. And these are after tax, so after transfers. If you look at income distribution across the United States, So what you notice is that the median household income, so half of all households in the United States earn less than $51,000, and half of all households earn more than $51,000. We don't use the average because the average would be skewed much higher because there's so much wealth and income in the high income. So only 25% of all households, and that's all earners in a household, earn more than $85,000 a year. And we have 4% of households earn more than $200,000. I think we're used to thinking of the United States as the richest country in the world. We're not. China is now. China actually has more wealth than the United States. The global wealth in 2015 is estimated at $250 trillion. It's down slightly from 2014 because the dollar is strong, and much of the wealth is held overseas, and so that wealth, compared to when you look, take into account in exchange rates, has actually gone down slightly. But wealth inequality is actually growing faster than income inequality. China holds about 16% of the world's wealth, United States about 13%, Japan 9, Italy 4, Germany 4, United Kingdom 4, goes down from there. Another way of looking at this is who has the wealth. And in this case, about two-thirds of the people in the world hold about 3% of the world's wealth. And so we've got about less than 1% have 41,000. And actually, I looked at some more recent statistics from Credit Suisse, and they're saying that in 2015, 1% will hold 50% of the world's wealth. 1% of the world's population will hold 50% of the world's wealth. That means that 1% has as much as the entire 99% of the rest of the world. Another way of looking at this is how have the Gini coefficients, how has income inequality changed over time? This is data from 1980 to 2010. 421 billionaires in the United States own over 10.5% of GDP. In India, 48 billionaires control the equivalent of almost 11% of India's GDP. It's really stunning when you look at these income inequalities. And I just want to say, as an economist, I want to remind people that the founder of economics, Adam Smith, assumed that everybody had equal access to resources. And the whole concept of productivity was based on the fact that we all had equal access to resources, and that those of us who were more productive in using those resources could then show that and be rewarded for that productivity. But the assumption always that he made very explicit is that we're all starting from the same base, that we all have equal access to resources. And if this graphic shows you nothing else, it shows you that we don't. Okay, so there have been a lot of studies about what contributes to inequality and what contributes to equality. So these are policies that inhibit inequality or promote equality. And this is based on an OECD, again, a study from the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, which is actually based in Paris. And what they did was a comparison of policies across OECD countries. And what they found was that there was a correlation between income equality and education, and particularly policies that promote graduation rates. Not testing, but promote graduation rates. And then also policies that promote access to secondary and university, that promotes income equality. Surprise, higher minimum wages promote income equality, right? They inhibit income inequality. Stronger labor unions promote income equality. They inhibit inequality. An IMF study, International Monetary Fund, also came to these same conclusions. Job protection, especially for temporary and contract workers, reduce inequality. And all of you, I think, should be aware of the fact that there's so many more contract workers out there now. And in fact, there was a recent ruling about contract workers actually being employees. Companies are using these techniques of hiring contract workers and claiming they're not responsible for them. But they tell them when they work, where they work, how they work, what their salaries are. They're employees. Better health outcomes also are related to income equality. And policies that integrate immigrants and fight discrimination promote income equality, inhibit income inequality. So these are things that are working, and it is complicated. It's not any one single thing. Tax policies are another big aspect. And in fact, Germany actually has more unequal income distribution before tax. And France has about the same income inequality before tax as we do. So tax policies can really improve the income equality. So let me talk a little bit more about tax policies and transfers. 3/4 of the reduction in income inequality is in the OECD countries is due to transfers, income transfers. But the impact really varies widely. We have countries where the transfers are small and targeted to those in need. Those don't work as well, surprisingly, at reducing income inequality. Countries like Australia and the U.S. use those. What seem to work better are these transfers that are large, widespread, over the life cycle. And I think part of the reason they work is because since everybody receives them, there's a lot of buying and support publicly for these transfers. And they're basically transfers over the life cycle of people. They're not targeted to just people in poverty. So I'm talking about, for example, the fact that in Germany, for example, women who stay home with children actually get pension rights. And there's actually paid maternity leave in many of these countries. So these are life cycle transfers in terms of, you know, at times when you may not be earning incomes, you get income coverage. And because all mothers receive this, there's a lot of support for these programs. Obviously, personal income tax can be the most progressive, but things like Social Security deductions, consumption taxes, and real estate taxes tend to be regressive. And for example, the Social Security tax tends to be regressive because we cut it off. It's now at $118,500. Incomes above that do not pay Social Security. We could solve our Social Security problem by just saying there's no cap. Mm-hmm. Like that. Yeah. And make everybody earning income and stock options and everything pay Social Security tax on their entire income. We'd have a surplus. And then, of course, capital gains is very regressive. So raising the capital gains taxations would increase equity. Another factors that foster inequities are offshoring of wealth, tax havens. A study by Henry in 2012 estimated that between $21 and $32 trillion of wealth are being offshored around the world. That means people are not paying taxes on that. Other things that the International Monetary Fund, has identified as increasing income and wealth inequalities are financial openness, deregulation, and globalization. They say there's mixed results with trade agreements. And the other issue is this, what's called the rising skills premium. What's happening is that the salaries of those in the tech fields are rising actually faster than the productivity of that group. And so there's this increasing salary reward that people in the tech fields are getting that really isn't proportional to their productivity. It's really just proportional to people's perception or the scarcity of these people. And there's a complete disconnect between labor productivity and wages. This is according to the IMF. And this is contributing to inequality. There's this divergence over time between the wage index. The wages are going down in real terms, but productivity is going up. And so over time, you see this increasing gap between wages and productivity. And that's across a whole series of different countries in OECD. So what are some of the consequences? The IMF has said, looking at the data, income inequality decreases GDP growth. So if you want the economy to grow, you need a more equal, distribution of income and wealth. And it should make sense to you, because think about what happens when you increase the income of the bottom 20%. What do they do with that? They spend it. And that group is, you know, they owe money, so they pay down debt. They buy things. They spend it. What do the top 20% do? They save it, or they buy pink and blue diamonds.
Or ship it overseas.
Or ship it overseas. So if you want to grow the economy, redistribute the income. And the other problem with inequality is it reduces mobility between generations. The whole concept of an American dream and the fact that, you know, you can do better than, you know, your parents. I'm a parent, and I look at my children and I go, I just sigh because the opportunities that they're going to have are just not the same opportunities that I had. And what's really interesting is poverty rates are declining in developing countries, but they're increasing in developed countries. In the countries that can afford to eradicate poverty, it's been a deliberate policy choice not to. And also, inequality of income means that you have inequality of financial services, you have inequality in terms of educational opportunities and education quality. You also wind up getting differences in healthcare access, and worst of all, in terms of health outcomes. Income inequality kills people. And it dampens investment, it dampens growth, and it also fosters political instability. So it's associated with overextension of credit, financial deregulation, larger deficits, and social conflicts. So I just want to tie in immigration into this, because this is a topic that's near and dear to my heart. So there are 11.3 million undocumented workers in the United States in 2014. 52% of them are from Mexico. These undocumented workers are 3.5% of our population, over 5% of our labor force. They are 7% of all kids in the United States, K through 12, have at least one undocumented parent. Here in Wisconsin, about half of all the milkers in our dairy state are undocumented workers. The industry could not survive without them. I also wanted to say this is another consequence of inequality is slavery. There are more slaves alive today than there were in 1850. They generate about $150 billion per year in profits to traffickers. 78% of them are in forced labor. 22% are sex slaves. Over a quarter are children, over half are women or girls. Put this in perspective. In 1850, the average slave in the U.S. South cost the equivalent of $40,000 per slave in today's dollars. You can buy, the average slave today costs $90. Average. That is a consequence of inequality of wealth. So I'm going to close by saying, by using a quote from Justice Louis Brandeis. We may have democracy or we may have wealth concentration in the hands of a few, but we cannot have both. And I also just want to say one thing that Justice William O. Douglas said about Brandeis. Brandeis was a militant crusader for social justice, whoever his opponent might be. He was dangerous, not only because of his brilliance, his arithmetic, and his courage. He was dangerous because he was incorruptible. Thank you.
There are two critical issues that I think we're facing
that we are nearing the tipping point. One of them is climate change and global warming. The other is income inequality. It affects us not just in terms of our economy. It's really about our democracy and whether or not of, by, and for the people can survive. It's not a new problem. In fact, I have a statement that was made by Plutarch going back a long, long time. He said, "An imbalance between rich and poor is the oldest and most fatal ailment of all republics." That's a critical thing, I think, to really think about. And I'd like to share with you a couple illustrations, I think, that for me represent how serious that issue of income inequality has become. You've probably heard of two brothers, Charles and David Koch. Well, between the two of them, they each made a net gain of over $6 billion in 2012. That is equivalent to a stack of $100 bills more than 12 feet high per hour. The average household family income per year is equivalent to a stack of about 2.3 inches per year. Frankly, I don't understand why people aren't in the streets. Because this is absurd to the point of ridiculousness. Another illustration came out of a book by Robert Reich, a book called Beyond Outrage. He pointed out that the tax breaks in 2001 and 2003, which were extended in 10 and 11, resulted in a greater transfer of income to the top 1% than the total income of the bottom 99% combined. This is totally beyond the pale, and as I indicated earlier, it threatens not just our economy, as already has been illustrated, but it really threatens the essence of what it means to have a democracy, because along with the transfer of income is a transfer of power, and it's reflected in terms of control of the media. It's reflected in terms of control of our politics and the politicians and the Congress. A comment made by Bernie Sanders, who's running for president, he said, "No president can do this by themselves. It's going to require a movement to change this around." And frankly, I'm hoping that that's where we're going to be going. It's interesting, there seemed to be some growing awareness of this issue, even in more conservative circles. And the CEO, or former CEO of Home Depot, recently, who was very right-wing conservative, expressed alarm at growing income inequality because of what it might portend. Now, there are three things, really, that contribute most significantly to income inequality, which have been touched on. One is wages and unions. The other is the differential between income that's earned versus income that's the result of investments. And a second issue is trade policy. This is coming up as a huge issue, and I would encourage people to really pay attention to an issue that's really on the front burner right now, which is the TPP, or Trans-Pacific Partnership, which has a number of things in which, from my perspective, really will only exacerbate the growing problem of income inequality. The third issue is taxes and difference between how earned income and wages are treated from standpoint of taxes, and how investment income is treated. And the fact, as was suggested earlier, how much of the income or earnings or so on, particularly for the very wealthy, is never touched. It's moved overseas, it's offshored. 57% of the U.S. companies doing business in this country paid not a penny in federal income tax between 1996 and 2005. Not a penny. General Electric, Boeing, many of the largest, wealthiest corporations in the world pay not a single penny in federal income tax, but they use our infrastructure, our schools, the internet, our highways. How do we expect to survive as a country with that kind of growing income inequality and the disparity between what people earn and what they pay to support the basic services that are essential to any country, and particularly to any democracy? There's the whole notion of the market and the suggestion that, well, trends in economics are really just response to the market. Well, that's not true. free market is a rare, very rare thing these days. It's often manipulated and controlled in ways that have produced the kind of disparity that we have seen in some of the slides that are up here. I think I've got a phone going off in my pocket here. One of the things that is interesting, a reference was made earlier to Adam Smith, considered the father of modern economics and capitalism, and he said something I thought quite interesting. He said, the subjects of every state ought to contribute toward the support of the government as nearly as possible in proportion to their respective abilities, that is, in proportion to the revenue which they respectively enjoy under the protection of the state. Sounds a lot like progressive income tax. But it's really critical in terms of understanding the importance of having a progressive tax system if we're going to be having any shot at balancing out the growing income inequality. So thank you.
I'm thinking about what is happening around the world. And one of the things that struck me last night when I heard a French reporter interviewed, as people were just beginning to take in the magnitude of the violence that had happened across Paris, but what its implications were. And she said, this coupled with the migrations, the fleeing of Syria and the violence coming out of Syria and the numbers, sheer numbers of refugees pouring into Europe and the response there, that they are very frightened about, with this dramatic violence, about the rise of populism.
You are listening to Barbara Lawton, former Lieutenant Governor of Wisconsin, speaking on income inequality and what you can do about it. The talk was held on November 14, 2015, and sponsored by the Madison Institute. She's part of a panel discussion, along with Professor Lydia Zepeda and Charlie Upoff.
And we're seeing that this year, in a presidential year, populism in two different forms, and populism can take different forms. I mean, we probably in this room like to think of it as a movement toward reform and an empowerment of the people and an evening out of things. But populism can also be generated out of a deeply unsettled feeling, but be a movement toward a single leader who promises to make it better. Think of the populism, not the union buster or the big busters of the large corporations' hold on our economy in the early 20th century, but the pull toward George Wallace, which was a populism in the South. And so we're seeing it in the Tea Party and on the far right, in one form where it's a reaction that is pulled by a magnetic force of the promise of a single leader, pull toward reform that we see more on the far left. I can't remember which way I'm pulling here. Probably mostly under Bernie Sanders, the people who are following him, but we're feeling all this. Another thing, I've just shared with you a few reflections before I get to fully what I came to talk about. When I looked at that, the Gini graphing or listing of countries with the greatest inequality, with Chile, Mexico, Turkey, and the United States at the top, our family has had the unique privilege to live in three of those four countries. We have lived for a year in Chile, and we have lived for 6 months in Mexico and obviously in the United States. And I remember at the end of our time in both Mexico and Chile, loved living there, loved the opportunity to be immersed in a culture. But what I also felt was that there was a great moving sort of thundering under the ground like an earthquake, and we lived through earthquakes in both of them. Instability owing to that huge wealth gap that was not going to change under the way the country was operating at that point. That in Chile, for instance, about at that time when we were there, and I don't know that it significantly changed, I don't think so, given those numbers, about 5% of the people in Chile could hope to send their children to college. And there were a handful of major employers in the country. So you couldn't even just quit your job. You had to beg your leave because you couldn't sever relationships with the owner of wealth in the country. A tremendous power, you can imagine, over people, the same people who own the natural resources that keep an economy moving. So all of these bring us to think about where we are here in the United States in that context. And as I looked at the title of our conversation today, Income Inequality, What You Can Do, I will definitely get to what you can do, believe me. I have a list. But I also, just being probably like most of us in this room, we have a little bit or a lot of us in us that goes against the grain or questions things. I want to question the focus on income inequality and broaden a conversation to the inequality, to economic inequality, because we can't just talk about the outcome, which is basically income inequality. We have to talk about the inequality of opportunity, which is defined by the economic inequality. So as Lydia told us, next year, 1% of the wealth will be 1% of the people that will hold half of the global wealth. And I want to give you another look at it, that in the United States, a lot of us can feel, I can tell you that, knowing my little baby pension from my time in office, the 100 largest CEO retirement accounts in the United States combined are worth $4.9 billion that generate an average monthly check for each of those CEOs, monthly check of $278,000. That combined retirement account of 100 people is equal to the savings of 50 million American families. This has a profound effect on how we live and what we can do and what we can empower. And this is not an economic problem. This is a political problem. This is a very big political problem. And it's revealed in the fact that the people who hold the very few people who hold so much wealth have the political power in the way that elections are run today to restructure our economy to keep that gap growing and to keep them in place. And so it's an erosion of so many forms of our education, health, social, economic, and political support for families, schools, and communities. It's a breakdown building up, actually, of what Joseph Stiglitz calls a legal framework for rules that lock in inequality. It is a privatization of risk because we're not sharing the risk, we're holding the risk. There are huge implications, as noted by the migrations, not just out of Syria with refugees, but that we've seen in the African continent, that we see of undocumented workers coming to the United States that have brought leaders in the United States to speak of building a wall and people to rise up in hatred in this country that depends on that labor, that this is a destabilizing impact. Climate change, when we don't address it in those changes where people can no longer grow their food and maintain their farms and have to move. The growing instability that comes with this. In 2014, at the World Economic Forum in Davos, they recognized economic instability as the second greatest worldwide risk. And in that list, they said that severe income disparity was the number four global risk of the year. This year at Davos, at the World Economic Forum, deepening income inequality was the number one trend, but they didn't identify it as a risk. The risk comes back to economic instability, and the inability to see how those are inextricably linked is interesting. The IMF, again, as Lydia pointed out, interestingly, we can be relieved, asserts that this extreme wealth that is governing public decision making, and that this excessive inequality does not support sustainable growth, because we've got $25 trillion in tax havens and not creating jobs and producing. And I want to talk later about the job creation. But we can see how the forces of great wealth can change the structures of a democracy, not only in the public policies that we see trending toward privatization of not only K-12, but with this year, with the continuing draining away of funds from our university system to push it toward that. This is all a very conscious, careful move. But we saw it most blatantly when Governor Walker abandoned his presidential campaign and came back to the state. His budget, which Republicans and Democrats alike would tell you had nothing to do with building a strong economic future and social stability in our state for the state of Wisconsin, his budget was a love letter to his donors. Nothing less than that. And when he came back to the state, instead of coming back to say, oh my, our economic development corporation is a mess, and I'm going to lead a restructuring of that and look at how we can do things to rebuild strength in this state. No, he went right for the end of the list for the love letter to his donors, and that was to make it more difficult to vote, right, to allow more dark money, to bring in more money into campaigns so that people can, the ownership is more easily accessible, to take the cop off the beat in the accountability with our government accountability boards and make it impossible, literally follow the FEC model of paralysis, of institutional paralysis, so that there is no cop on the beat to hold anyone accountable for following our election laws. And that's the kind of thing that reshapes an economy and allows the amassing of power, of political power. I want to talk a little bit then about the issues of money and politics. And I want to talk about the technology sector that seems to be off the table in the campaigns and all around, and how that fits into this picture of growing inequality, economic inequality. I'm sure most of you saw, interestingly, by the way, Jill Lepore from The New Yorker magazine wrote an article in last March titled Richer and Poor, How Much Inequality Can a Democracy Bear? And in the course of that article, she reviews three important reports from national organizations and five very contemporary books, all addressing the issue of economic inequality. And not one of them makes the connection to money and politics. OMG. We got that. I'm hip, trust me. I've got four grandchildren trying to help me with that. We heard it. The connection was made with Robert Reich a couple weeks ago, right, at the library, when he said, look, that there, it's a false argument and connection that has been made that we either can have free arguments or free markets or we will have big government, and that is a false opposition. And he said what is more important to talk about is who is government for? That government, there are no markets without government, but how does government regulate them to either support a democracy and equal opportunity that is part of equal economic opportunity, or to perpetuate and exacerbate inequality. And of course, he also makes in various fronts in many that the linkage between economic power and political power, that the dominant, the largest and the dominant corporations gain political influence over how the markets that impact their profits are maintained and enforced. And so it increases their economic power, which increases their political power. And quite frankly, we move further and further out into the margins of this picture. In 2013, the top 0.01% of political donors, that's 24,000 people, gave 40% of the contributions. In 1980, as a point of comparison, it was they gave 10% of the contributions. So now they gave 40% of the contributions. And as that, as you think of that rising curve, know that in that period of time, as they increased their investment in our democracy, they tripled their income. It's a good investment. In 2012, just a few years ago, single donor PACs, a PAC that wasn't a bunch of people Karl Rove brought together or somebody else, but single donor PACs gave 4% of the political money in 2012. In 2014, just 2 years later, it had increased to 16% by a factor of 4. And it will be interesting, and this year, actually, I expect it will be even a higher arc that we will see, because what we've seen is that these campaigns have become billionaires' playgrounds, and it's not difficult to get into the game for them. And the money isn't all that much. It's Christoph said billionaires adopt presidential candidates as if they were racehorses. But for them, for those billionaires, it's only a hobby expense. And as a point of an illustration, in 2012, Sheldon Adelson gave $12 million. $92 million in 2012. $92 million as a portion of his wealth would represent $300 for the median American family. So the number is huge. And we all can dream of what we could do with $92 million in this city or in this state or even across this country to move important changes. But for him, it was literally pocket change. And today, the New York Times had a headline not long ago that half of all the money that's coming into these campaigns is coming from only 158 families. A lot of this growth in extreme wealth and a lot of the concentration of it in a few hands, so the growth in the wealth and the concentration, is in the tech world, because that's where a lot of the money is. And I would like to note that unlike in Europe, where they have been bringing lawsuits about the privacy of the of citizens, the way that Google is operating or Facebook is operating, et cetera, they don't think that they are untouchable gods in their economy, but because maybe they grew in our soil and they have driven so much profound change, and we somehow have had taken in an adoration that certainly suits their own view of themselves, that we have not been too critical. But think about how when Google announced just recently that they were going to reshape their business now under a new name, and it was going to be reshaped as a conglomerate like GE, who offshores most of their money, and as we've discovered, so does Apple and Microsoft and all of that. but as a conglomerate. But think about how Amazon, Google, Facebook, LinkedIn, the biggest of those tech companies that have changed the landscape and have created billionaires, many billionaires, but how they have become a barrier to entry into entrepreneurism and into different kinds of business. So we can't really have a hands-off. There's such an intersection of technology in Silicon Valley and the way that they're changing the economy. It's not the organization man of the 20th century. It's the network man, right, of the 21st century. But that tremendous wealth is deciding where the smartest investments are in the private sector. They're the source of the venture and angel capital, but also in the public sector because of a growing political power. And there's this instinct in all of them not only to do no evil, which also made us believe in Google and think that they were sort of coming out of the 60s or something, but they have an instinct to blow it up. And their first foray into politics, mind you, was something called Forward.us. The issue was immigration. They were upset about the caps on immigration, and they weren't able to bring in the talent they needed to drive their companies forward. And so they gathered a lot of money from the top people and created this. But then their first move was to try to make friends with people on both sides of the aisle. So to make friends with the Republicans, they created and put millions of dollars behind ads supporting this Keystone Pipeline and mm-hmm. offshore drilling. And then it was wild. So then they came under such intense criticism that they closed that down quickly. And now they have a new lobbying organization that is to give them a very strong presence in Washington, D.C., called the Economic Innovation Group. But here's some of what is in the Silicon Valley mindset. I mean, someone described their worldview as that society is a land of Prometheus. You remember Prometheus, the creator and greatest benefactor of mankind who gave us fire. That society is a land of Prometheus, bound by, and by the way, Silicon Valley would be Prometheus, bound by a constricting web of old institutional arrangements that the internet must clear away. And they think it can be done through internet-enabled networks. So there's a real sense of heroism. You know, we can save this. But there's also the sense that there was a reporting on a gathering just last January of some of the biggest names. They called them apocalyptic libertarians of Silicon Valley, who gathered to set an agenda and set a course for the year. Everyone was a capitalist. Everyone was post-political. They have enough wealth to be post-political, right? That's true. And they take it on faith that a corporate capitalism unchecked just a little bit longer will bring about the era of widespread abundance. And they see that progress is threatened by the political power of what one of their leaders, Thiel, calls the unthinking demos. That's us. Right, right. There's an article just a couple of weeks ago in the New Yorker, a long article, a profile of Reid Hoffman, who founded LinkedIn, who has been an early investor. He's a multi-billionaire and a real leader and thought leader in this, who has, it appears, thought altruistic motives. But one of the problems in this whole sector is a lot of people who believe that they did this by virtue of their extraordinary intellect. And not good luck of being where they were, which is part of it, surrounded by what they were surrounded by. And so they really believe that they know better than this unthinking demos. Reid Hoffman was meeting with another one of the big money guys, and they were going over the idea of a Kickstarter purchase of the presidency so that they could put Bloomberg in place, that they felt he was probably the only one who got it. Mm-hmm. They believe, and Hoffman is very strong about this, but this is indicative of the sector, that when the United Nations reported that we would need a certain person, I can't remember how many new jobs for across the globe for sustainability over the next 20 years, he believes that 90% of them are going to have to come from startups. And so societies are going to have to make entrepreneurship easier. And believe me, I have thought about that. And as in the role of lieutenant governor and the responsibility for looking at how we would shape a growing economy. And entrepreneurship is very important to it. But we have to, when we think about public resources and where they're invested in stimulating an economy and creating jobs that will be good jobs and move people into positions of opportunity, we have to remember how few jobs are really created at this moment in entrepreneurship in technology. Hoffman thinks of the 600 million jobs that are estimated that we need to be created in the next year, that 90% of them must and can come from startups. But a very rigorous 20-year study found that 75% of the co-founders of startup businesses who got venture funding, and that's a very small minority of many more who tried to get venture funding, 75% of them wind up making nothing. Yeah. So these guys, again, with just like Sheldon Adelson with his $92 million into a single election cycle, it's pocket change, they can afford to lose in their investments in these startups, but they get ownership in each one that they invest in, right? When we're talking about public investment in creating the circumstances that will be conducive to this, we have to be more careful. We can't actually afford to lose that much. It's estimated that of the 30,000 startups per year that we see, just 10 of 30,000 represent 97% of the total value of all of those 37,000. Sound familiar? That incredible concentration. And not only that, that just one of those 10 will represent the total value of all of the rest of the 30,000. So there's this extraordinary inequality even in this sector in how it works.
You are listening to Barbara Lawton, former Lieutenant Governor of Wisconsin, speaking on income inequality and what you can do about it. She's part of a panel discussion along with Professor Lydia Zepeda and Charlie Upoff.
I worry about when we talked about this, we can see this agitating discomfort. Lots of people understand that something is wrong and how it is reflected in this year in a presidential primary. In a growing populism, we could see it. There was just recently an article in the New York Times business section about how it appears that we're pursuing the anti-politician. And they write about how they really did a careful study of South Carolina Republicans, where wages are completely stagnant for hourly workers. And there's not a real movement afoot to raise the minimum wage, right? But those South Carolina Republicans want less government. And they say in an interview that, yep, but we're Republicans because we hope and believe that those rich people will create jobs. And we're upset with the status quo. We haven't seen it change. So we want an outsider who's shown us they can create jobs to come in and do this. without ever thinking through the conflict of interest in that, huh? The Wall Street Journal wrote about the rise of populism in the GOP primary, and they were referring to an exchange in the debate last week about the bailing out of banks. And one financial industry analyst observed about that exchange between candidates, "It seemed yet one more example of how the wounds of the financial crisis have yet to heal. And those who try to talk rationally about it are disadvantaged among populace." Mm-hmm. So there's not a hope of rational talk. Norm Ornstein said the candidates all promoted ideas that appealed to the antediluvian base. Mm-hmm. And when you think about it, when they've analyzed Trump's support fairly recently, it's across the Republican ideological spectrum. It's moderate and left-leaning Republicans, and it's centrist Republicans, and it's obviously the far-right Republicans. But if you look at it by class, by economic class, it is 2-1 poor whites. And when we think about the issue that was raised, that brought us here, income inequality, the Democrats are talking not about economic inequality so much as income inequality, and the Republicans counter with arguments about mobility, to get away from that sense. So the issue, though, is economic stratification and the rise of a very super wealthy class that is threatening our democracy. The public is not ignorant to this. And when there was a poll just October 15th by Bloomberg, and they demonstrated that there is bipartisan consensus on the issue of money in politics, that 80% of Republicans and 83% of Democrats agree that Citizens United has been damaging to our democracy and needs to be overturned. 87% of all of them, the Republicans and Democrats combined, say that campaign finance system needs to be reformed. This is what they answered. Campaign, in quotes, campaign finance should be reformed so a rich person does not have more influence than a person without money. 87% of all of them. 59% agreed with this statement. Our political system is broken. We just need to start over. At the Republican debate this last week in Milwaukee, remember, Fox flashed a word cloud of the issues that people were talking about on Facebook, and the size of the words indicated what they were talking or what was getting the most play. And among the very largest word clusters up there was campaign finance. Not a single question about it was asked in the debate. It was prominent. So there's a big gap out there between what the public understands about why, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, your situation is not only not improving, but getting worse. And they get that. And they get that there's no honest brokering on policy ideas and debate, because as we saw here, the money drives the policy that gets to the table for a vote. And it wasn't just Scott Walker who's getting all of that money from the Kochs. His Republican majority legislators can see that that's a future source of funds for them. And there were only three in the Assembly and one in the Senate that opposed changing the GAB of the Republicans, because no matter how safe your seat is, you're going to continue to need money, and that's a great reliable source of money. It's like an ATM machine. So there's this huge gap that is at least as big as the wealth gap in this country between what we know and what the candidates are saying to us, and not just the candidates for president. I would tell you, and I have written a letter to her to say, really, could you take the next step? Elizabeth Warren last December wrote a fabulous op-ed piece in the Washington Post and talked about what is happening in this country and how we are being driven further and further from the opportunity to participate equally in this economy, et cetera, et cetera. And it was, the whole op-ed was like a crescendo building to, and none of it will change unless we get the money out of politics and change the way we finance our elections. But it stopped. It stopped like it, right as you were, you know, in a music. Think about it. You build a crescendo and boom, silence. And I thought, really? What the polling would show you that this is a triumphant place to be, and people get it, and you don't have to do a lot of explaining. And as I'll tell you shortly, there are lots of things you can suggest for people to do and ways to do it. Hillary Clinton announced a 5-point plan, probably. All of her plans seem to be. it's a in evaluation of how much math we can all take, I bet. No, but she announced a 5-point plan or some plan on campaign finance reform. A very thoughtful, very strong, finally we're getting it. I mean, President Obama promised us. He's done nothing. The people who care about this are deeply disappointed. She has a plan. She announces it on the same day that she made her formal apology for her emails. So it got zero coverage. And she has not mentioned it since. And when she did an interview with Rachel Maddow was posing finally a question that all of these candidates, every single one of them, should have to answer about Wall Street and the technology sector both. Identifying that these are two major threats to equality in the way that the status quo is operating now. And she poses the question about their influence on the shape of our politics and on the shape of our democracy. And she said, I think it's a bigger issue, and went into, I don't remember, child care taxes, this or that. No, those are not bigger issues. This is the only issue if you want to get to those. This is the gateway issue to be able to do anything about taxes or public education or public health questions. You can't do it unless you can make honest brokers of the people who are voting on this. In fact, I have to tell you, yeah.
What was the question Maddow asked?
Maddow posed a question. I don't have her exact reading, but it was, how will you address, aren't you concerned about the undue influence of Wall Street and the technology sector? And it seems to me to be, it's more than Dodge share how, you know, what you're going to do about regulations, because what we can see is that the powerful money, both in lobbying and in campaign contributions, has been able to adjust the regulations and the goals and the ambition of what we do all along. So there's also an unwillingness to question the role of tech. John Dickerson, who moderated last Saturday night's Democratic debate in Des Moines, said one of the main disagreements within the Democratic Party right now is whether the growing gap in economic inequality results from a tilted playing field where policies benefit Wall Street and big business, or broader factors such as new technology and globalization. And he went on to say that even though all three debate participants, Clinton, Sanders, and O'Malley, subscribe to the tilted playing field theory, they disagree about how to correct it. They're all taking a pass on addressing new technology and globalization in a fundamental way connected to those. Bernie Sanders is the one who gets the closest and gets it the most and who speaks the most clearly about the need to change our campaign finance system. And there's been a lot of op-eds in the last 2 days leading up to tonight urging Hillary Clinton to take that thing out of the file and talk about it because it's so important. So what can we do when this economic stratification and the rise of a super wealthy class, a small and intensely super wealthy class that keeps gaining more, threatens the very possibility and institutions of a democracy? There's actually quite a lot we can do because it does come down to the issue of money and politics. It does, the importance of leadership is, I mean, it couldn't be more important. Who is president? Who is governor? Could not be more important. President Obama, by the way, has had the possibility of providing all kinds of leadership with executive orders to say that anybody who wants to have a federal contract has to get out of the business of making political contributions. Really simple to do. He could do that. There's also, and he, people have been begging him and sending signatures, and you can add to the signature list. And it that has been going on for at least 18 months, and he hasn't done anything yet. But understanding the importance of the role of somebody who says this is a top agenda item. I remember in Connecticut when I can't remember the name of the governor. He went into obscurity. Who had to leave suddenly in a scandal, and his lieutenant governor became governor. Jody Rell, and she was a Republican. They were Republicans. And the scandal had shaken their state and was so outrageous that she said, my first act, I insist, will be to institute public funding of campaigns in our state. And don't ask me to sign another bill until you put that on my desk. And Connecticut was the first state in the nation that had a public funding of campaigns bill come through the legislature, not come to them through a ballot initiative. And it was a Republican woman who just said, put it there and don't talk to me about anything else till it's there. So leadership can make all of the difference in the world. We have a tremendous opportunity in this moment where all of those polls tell us how people are unsettled and understand what this situation of their position of economic inequality is and how it's connected to money and politics and and the people who hold office. We've seen that, and we've seen that it's bipartisan, that it's not an issue of the left, thank God, anymore, because you can't pass it. You can't move it through a legislature if it's locked in one corner or another. But when you think that 16 states have passed advisory referendum or ballot initiatives calling for the overturning of Citizens United, in Colorado, the vote was by 75%. In Montana, it was by 75%. 16 states have done that. Over 600 communities. In Wisconsin, those communities include Waukesha, not a hotbed of liberalism, Elkhorn, worse, Green Bay, Wisconsin. It was on the November ballot last year when the majority of people in Green Bay, Wisconsin voted for the third time to elect Scott Walker to the position of governor. 75% of them voted to advise overturning Citizens United. This is a huge moment of opportunity with us to take those people and focus them on something that can be done now, more quickly, with a powerful impact as we work toward that goal, because it is an important goal. But I'm still waiting for the Equal Rights Amendment, so I know how long it can take, right? That's God help us. So you can work locally. We can, and we should. I mean, oh, my God, what's wrong with Madison? Where, remember, I was elected out of Green Bay, Wisconsin, and I'll never forget coming down here when I was a candidate for state senate. First time I'm running for office, everything is new to me, and I'm being introduced to a group of people who have gathered at a fundraiser, I think for Progressive Wisconsin, is that? Progressive Dane, right. Thank you. Progressive Dane was holding a fundraiser for their candidates for city council and county board and invited these statewide candidates to come to get to know the people who had gathered. And the candidates for the local offices were saying, we have to maintain a progressive majority. And I'm thinking, you know, if Green Bay had one progressive on that city council, that would be so wild. So this is, Madison has every opportunity to work locally. Last Tuesday in Seattle, they passed a ballot initiative by 20% that uses real estate taxes as a source of money to give every single registered voter in city elections, $100 in democracy vouchers. Four $25 vouchers per election cycle for them to donate to a candidate. And the candidates who accept those accept with them lower spending limits, and they agree to participate in three debates. There were also parts of that initiative that put into place for city elections stronger anti-corruption laws. The city of Tallahassee, Florida, I would argue, again, not a hotbed of radicalism or even liberalism, a year and a half ago passed a complex of new ordinances, all directed at cleaning up their elections and empowering small donors, called an anti-corruption law. They worked with the organization Represent.us, and they have changed the shape of their elections, which can begin to look like they do in New York City, where they have had public funding of city elections for over 25 years now. And as they've collected data about it, what they've discovered is where before most of the money came from a few zip codes, all of them outside the city limits, actually. And now with public funding, where if Marilyn is running for a local seat and I give her $25, it's matched times six, and she now has $175. So she doesn't have to trot around begging for money from big donors who really do expect access and something from her. All of the people in her neighborhood can become big donors. And what has happened in New York City is that the money is equally spread throughout the precincts. And it's just fascinating. And participation in politics and elections has skyrocketed and improved. And they've got a whole data picture to show you. They've been collecting the data over 25 years. The difference it makes in governance and in participation. In Maine passed a public funding a few years ago, but these things are fragile, and you get a Republican governor who opposes public funding, they start to try to erode the power of the program. And there was a ballot initiative to beef it back up in Maine, and it passed by a huge margin last Tuesday. It beefed up the public financing, it increased disclosure requirements, it established fines and penalties for breaking their election laws across the state. San Francisco is taking sort of a baby step, but they created an expenditure lobbyist measure that ends secret lobbying in city politics and lays the groundwork for future reforms. Ohio banned gerrymandering on the ballot. Mm-hmm. Dick Durbin in the Senate, U.S. Senate, and John Sarbanes in the House both have public funding bills before the legislatures that ought to be acted on. So there's five principles that groups who've been working on reform have that are related to how we can reform. Everyone participates. Everyone knows. Everyone plays by common sense rules. Everyone is held accountable. Everyone has a voice. So if everyone participates, that means we have a system of funding our elections that allows small donors to be empowered and to strengthen the civic participation. Everybody knows full transparency and immediate disclosure of political contributions and expenditures. Everyone plays by common sense rules, that the political conflicts of interest are diminished as far as we can, and that new ethical norms take hold. Everyone is held accountable, that candidates, elected officials, and organizations are held accountable for breaking campaign finance laws, that we can't have something like the FEC saying this year, well, we're just not going to be able to enforce anything. Seriously, they did. And everyone has a voice. That Congress is constitutionally empowered to make laws governing the flow of money in and around politics, but that we also have full defensible voting rights. So that's what I'm thinking about when I think about inequality, that we have to look at the largest, most profound picture of how our economy is being reshaped by a relatively few people whose vested interest is in maintaining a status quo. Gridlock is good for them. And their increasing money in their pocket gives them increasing political power under the system today to continue to control the future of our economy and of our lives. So it's up to us, and the thing we can do about it is to act on the issue of money and politics. Thanks.
You've been listening to Income Inequality and What You Can Do About It, sponsored by the Madison Institute. The talk was held on November 14, 2015, and the speakers included Barbara Lawton, former Lieutenant Governor of Wisconsin, Professor Lydia Zepeda with the UW-Madison Department of Consumer Sciences and the School of Human Ecology, and Charlie Upoff, a board member with the Madison Institute. The talk took place on November 14, 2015, at Union South on the UW-Madison campus and was sponsored by the Madison Institute. For more thought-provoking programs, go to the Madison Institute's website, www.themadisoninstitute.org. The views expressed here are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the sponsor.